This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, David Chang, is one of the most celebrated chefs and restaurateurs in America. His first restaurant, Momofuku, was named the most important restaurant in America by Bon Appetit in 2013. It opened in 2004 in a small storefront in Manhattan's East Village and became known for ramen noodles, pork buns, and its casual atmosphere. Since then, Chang has opened more than a dozen restaurants in New York, L.A., Las Vegas, Toronto, and Australia. He's won 5 James Beard Awards, including Best New Restaurant and Outstanding Chef. He hosts the Netflix series Ugly Delicious, which focuses on foods and the cultures or mix of cultures that they derive from. He's also written a memoir called Eat a Peach. As you'd expect, the book is filled with insights about food and restaurants, but he also shares insights about himself. His parents immigrated from North Korea. When Chang was growing up, he was embarrassed by the foods they ate and how their kitchens smelled different from the kitchens of his friends' families. He has bipolar disorder, has frequently dealt with suicidal thoughts, and credits cooking and his restaurants with saving his life. Thank you again, David, for being here. So, David, you have so many restaurants. How many have you had to close because of COVID, and how many are open?
Well, first of all, Terry, it's a real honor to be part of your show. And in terms of the restaurants that we've had to close, we've closed 2, one in Washington, D.C., one in New York City, and we've had to temporarily relocate another. So all in sort of 3, and hopefully that number doesn't increase.
So a lot of your food has a Korean influence, even though it's not like authentic Korean food. But when you were growing up, I think Korean food was a real source of embarrassment to you. You were embarrassed by how your kitchen smelled. Kids used to make fun of you for it. How did your kitchen smell, and what made it smell that way?
Oh, man. Growing up, my kitchen smelled a lot of different things. I remember tripe. If you've ever cooked tripe at home,
it
smells.
Kidding?
Oh, man.
I have not.
My mom used to make tripe all the time. And that's just not something anybody's going to want to like smell or taste.
Explain what tripe is.
It's it is a stomach lining. There's several stomachs in a cow. It's basically the stomach of a cow, the stomach lining of a cow. And it has a very peculiar smell, and it can be made very delicious. But, you know, it wasn't just tripe. For the most part, it was something like kimchi or all the fermented goodness in Korean cuisine. And even something now that people love today is kim, the Korean seaweed snack that you can even buy at your convenience store or pharmacy. I see it being sold. I remember bringing that to school for lunch because I loved it. I snack on that my entire life. But as a kid, you know, you open up your lunchbox and you bring out something that looks like that is seaweed. Imagine in 1984, you know, kids saying like, what is that? And you say it's seaweed. They're like, ew, that's gross. That's like the nice version of people making fun of your food. Wait till they smell kimchi or doenjang or any of these fermented goodness things that people would make fun of me. And they said every possible name. And it's not just Korean food, Terry. You know, it's a story that anyone that's an immigrant to America can share, right? It's all the foods that most people have no idea. But now in 2020, everybody finds delicious. So it's just funny how it all plays out.
So both of your parents are from North Korea. And their family lived there before the North and the South became separate entities. And I think your grandfather was alive when Japan invaded Korea and basically tried to make Korea into a satellite of Japan and have everybody assimilate into Japanese culture. You thought you were eating Korean food. Was it Japanese food or Korean food? Or some mix of the two?
It was a mix, but my grandfather came from a well-to-do family. My father came from like nothing. My mother came from a very prominent family. And like many well-to-do young men, he was educated to be Japanese. He didn't like Korean food. He went to college and higher education all in Japan. And, you know, Japan colonized Korea, like systematically tried to deprogram anything that was like from the language on up to the food that you make or eat. So my grandfather did not like Korean food at all. He never ate kimchi. He never ate the thing. So he always had Japanese things made for him. I was introduced to Japanese food at a very early age through him. And I think it's a main reason why I have such an affinity for Japanese food, because my grandfather was basically, you know, he's Korean. He spoke Korean, had Korean friends, but like in his heart, I think he was more Japanese than he was Korean. And when I came back from Japan, and my Japan was much better back then, he was so proud that he could speak in Japanese to me. He was so happy.
So when your parents emigrated from North Korea, what was the state of North Korea and where they lived? What did they have? What did they lack when they came here?
So my father was born on what is now the border of North Korea and China. My mother was born a little bit closer to what is now the 38th parallel in a town called Kaesong. And, you know, they like most people, fled to the south and they lost everything. And, you know, Korea is remarkable how people think about Korea today, but that progress and the success they've had, I think, makes people forget just how poverty-stricken Korea was. They lost everything. And I forget, even myself, that my parents were refugees, you know, for a long time. They lost everything. And my dad immigrated to New York in 1963 to work as a dishwasher because life was so hard. The better opportunity was going to be in America. And that's how it all happened. And he came back and he married my mother. And I think my mom came back to America in 68 or 67.
So do you think often about the distance between the lives that they had? Because they lived through the Korean War, right?
Yes, they did.
Yeah. So do you think often about the distance between the lives they had in North Korea and then South Korea when they lost everything and lived through war, what it was like raising you in suburbs?
You know, now that I'm a father, I think about it in a completely different way than I was growing up. And when I was a kid, I was just so angry at why they couldn't raise us like normal, you know, white America. And if it wasn't even then, I remember my dad's mother staying with us for a short period of time and how mean she was and how frugal she lived and how I just was like, not just embarrassed by the food, I was embarrassed by how they were raised. And I didn't want to be like that. And I'm remorseful of not trying to understand that at a younger age and what they lived and the experiences they had and just the cultural difference they had to overcome. Like my parents wound up in Northern Virginia, you know, in the early 70s, I don't even imagine what that was like. Or even for my dad who lived in New York, my dad hated New York City. He would visit me occasionally, but he hated it because of the trauma he had living there, you know, as a you know, kid in his early 20s that didn't speak English in the early 60s. I can't imagine how hard that must have been. So the older I've gotten, the more I'm moved by all they had to sacrifice and went through to give the family everything they needed.
But to put some perspective on your anger, you tell a story in your memoir about how when you were a kid, you were playing in a go-kart, and I guess it overturned, your leg was really injured. And for 5 days, you were saying, it hurt, you were crying. And your father said, just walk. And he'd put cream or ointment on it. And 5 days later, when your parents finally took you to the hospital, you had a badly broken femur, which is why you're in so much pain. And, you know, you were so angry at the way your pain was not taken seriously and that nothing was being done when your leg was in serious jeopardy. So I guess that's just like one example of why you grew up with so much anger toward your father. It's hard for kids to understand the kind of perspective that you were just talking about. But it sounds like that anger really stuck with you, though, for forever.
Yeah, unfortunately it did. And I mean, I'm trying not to be me, right? That's my mantra. Don't be me. And so much of it was an excuse to be angry in the past. And I'm trying to have a better understanding, not as an excuse for anything, but I've really thought about that. That's one story, right? I broke my leg. My dad would not let me go to the hospital, you know, for a few days. And I see a psychiatrist, and that's a lot to unpack, because now that I'm a father, I can't imagine letting my son not see a doctor if he broke his leg or got sick. So it caused me to evaluate like that my love, like his love for me was conditional, right? That I did something wrong. But when I think about it more, as terrible as that sounds in 2020, and it is terrible, my father was just trying to teach me how to be tough and how to survive. And when I think about it in relation to his mother, right, who stayed with us, she this is a funny story. She would wash dishes. My brother and I would like go like, check how crazy grandma is. She's washing dishes by spitting water out and like washing a plate like this. Because she had no running water before. It was about conserving water. And that was the easiest way for her to wash dishes. And every time she'd make rice, every kernel would be dried on the deck. And we'd be like, what are we doing? And she'd make us eat it later. But she was just trying to teach us how to survive. And when you're a little kid, you can't understand that. And if that's how she is, I imagine how she raised my father. And, you know, it takes a lot of, I think, empathy that I've tried to have a bigger reserve of to appreciate and to understand all the things I never understood about my father. And I'm still going through it. So in some ways I'm more angry than ever at my dad. In some ways I've forgiven him, and it's going to be a process.
I should mention he died in June, and I'm sorry. And I hope you got to like work some of those things out with him.
We did. Yeah. And he lived the full life.
So, you know, you mentioned that you were troubled. You were diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And, of course, you had it before you were diagnosed with it. So you didn't know, you didn't really have an understanding, I suppose, of what you were dealing with. And you went through a very long depression. You write about, like, your suicidal thinking. Accidents you got into where you weren't sure whether these were really accidents or whether you were flirting with hurting yourself, like falling through a glass table and nearly severing an artery and bleeding all over the place, stepping out into the street right in front of a bus and getting hit by the bus. It hurt, you write. What, were you injured badly?
I mean, it hurt. I mean, I always injured myself. Always, you know. And that bus thing hurt a lot, for sure. But I didn't break any bones, right? That I know, but unfortunately, I think there were many moments like that, that it's hard to remember exactly one kind of pain.
So during that period when you didn't really understand what you were dealing with and you had like months of depression and you were thinking about suicide, you didn't want to hurt your parents by actually doing it. But like how serious were you in your thinking? Is that too personal to ask? Is that...
No, I mean, it's not.
Is that inappropriate to ask?
It's not inappropriate. And part of the reason why I want to talk about this is so, you know, we can talk about these serious subjects that people never want to talk about. And it's hard to find, you know, stories that people can maybe relate to. And it's my story. And I'm always careful of talking about depression because I never want to see it as prescriptive for anybody else. But for me, I reached a point in my life where I just couldn't find meaning in anything.
Was this before you were cooking or after?
Oh, yeah. When I was in Japan, that was my first serious manic bout. But when I came back as a cook, when I was working at Cafe Blue, that was probably the lowest point I've ever experienced. And it's hard to ever explain to anybody that would question, like, why would you feel so bad? Like, come on, like, just step outside. I can talk about it now in a way that I never was able to talk about when experiencing it, because I know it's not my fault. It's a chemical reaction in my brain or a lack of certain things that are working in my brain. And there are certainly other factors involved culturally. There's things that happened in my life with my father or my upbringing. And it's hard to want to live, as crazy as that sounds, right? And you just think about all the different ways you can end it. And the craziest thing about depression to me after all these years is when you're in a state of serious depression, all you do is think about yourself. and that distorts things. And you're so sensitive to the hurt, and your self-confidence is at an all-time low, self-esteem at an all-time low, but you're simultaneously, you know, thinking that everything you think is the right thing, weirdly. You're convinced enough that anything you think is right and true. And it's this weird paradox. And I went through all of it, and that's why I tried to hurt myself in ways that didn't look like suicide. And I reached a point in my life where I had no reason or experience to open up a restaurant, but it reached a point where I literally was like, life or death is like a scenario, right? Like the worst thing is death. And the second worst thing is hurting other people along that road. The other thing is like everything else is okay, right? And for me, it was, okay, if I, what's the worst thing? What's the worst thing I can do? Okay, that. Okay, let's think about that. Before I choose to do that, let's try to do things that I would never do.
Take a risk. Take a risk, because what have you got to lose?
What have you got to lose? And that's what happened ultimately. And that's the hard part about my depression and why it's so intertwined with Momofuku. Was Momofuku was an exercise in combating depression. Otherwise, a 26-year-old with very little experience should never open a restaurant. And that's what happened. And if I wasn't depressed, I probably wouldn't have named the restaurant as silly as sounding as Momofuku, right? You know, everything I did was on, it seemed like I was a decision that was a one-way ticket, because I legitimately told myself, I'm going to see this as far as it can go. And if it doesn't work, well, this is all gravy anyway, right? And living that way, it was very powerful. It made me grow in different ways, because I'm a wallflower by nature. I'm not, you know, whatever I am today. And I changed in ways that I never thought, both good and bad. And depression was something that I used as a fuel to make me do things I would not normally do.
Once restaurants kind of saved your life, then you felt like you had become addicted to work, that you were like working constantly. What does it feel like in your life to feel like work has become an addiction? What did it feel like?
You know, I'm still working through it. And I just had a conversation with my wife last night, and she's like, you got to stop. You got to stop. You know, all I want to do is provide for my family. And that's ultimately what my father wanted. And the last thing I want to do is raise my family and my child the way I did my father. But I could still get the same result if all I do is work. And I'm trying to break these habits. It's really hard. And you know, in the book, I say the weird thing about work is that the last socially acceptable addiction. And the bottoming out in work addiction is at the peak of your career. You know, it's like it's the craziest thing.
I thought that was so perceptive when you wrote that, because usually like in memoirs or people talk about their lives, when they talk about bottoming out with an addiction, it's the absolute lowest point of their life. They're not functional anymore. But like you say, if you're addicted to work, the peak of your career is when you're most addicted.
It didn't really hit me until I would say a few years back, probably like 10 years into running Momofuku. My mom and dad, I was like, man, if they wanted to screw me up in the head before, they really did a good job at this moment when they said, you have to stop working so much. And I was like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
I was like, what? That's what I was like. This is now crazy. If they're telling me I'm working too much, like, I have reached a new level. And the hardest part, Terry, too, and this memoir and my work addiction, is it's my perspective. And I think along the way, I can rationalize anything in my addiction to work and proving people wrong and getting to my goals and reaching the metaphorical mountaintop. And as a culture, I feel like we put such a premium on doing that, and the sacrifice is worth it, right? And now I see that I hurt a lot of people along the way. And my book only represented some of those stories. And I'm really, really, some of those people I've reached out to over the years, former employees, family members, friends, when you're on the single-minded track to get to where you want to go, you know, it's borderline sociopathic to be like, yeah, it's worth it. I'm going to do this even though, you know what I mean? I'm going to keep on going. And we sort of celebrate that. And at least I internalized it as that. It's worth it. You got to get there. You got to do it. And you get there and you realize, what the hell was I doing? And that's where I'm at right now is I hope I've done more good than bad. And I think that I have. But I can't ask for forgiveness for the people I've wronged. I have to earn it, you know?
Let me say that in your book, you say that at some point you hired like an executive coach who was going to give you feedback about how to be a better executive and run your restaurants better. And I think the first thing the coach said to you was, it's amazing how long people have worked with you in your restaurants because they hate you. And I'm thinking, you probably paid a lot of money to hear that, but that must have really hurt to hear that. How did you change after hearing that? And why were they feeling so discontent with you?
Because I was a horrible boss. And I ruled with fear and commands and...
Like your father brought you up.
That's the hardest thing, is I spent my entire life making sure I would never be like my dad. And I wound up being exactly like my dad to so many people. And I just couldn't see it. But the best way I could describe it, Terry, when I realized that people hated my guts, was when you realize that you're the smelly kid. You know, like the smelly kid never realizes they smell bad. And I had to really accept that I wasn't even the worst kind of smelly kid. I was a smelly kid that always blamed everyone else for being smelly. And then I had to realize that I was the rotten one. And
so how did you change?
I'm still trying to change, Terry. This hasn't been an overnight process. And a lot of it is constantly revisiting the things I've said, the things I've done, and trying to analyze and how to be better and try to make sure that I don't repeat those mistakes. It's not just about, well, let me add this. I knew this change doesn't happen overnight. And I had all of this therapy and all of this coaching, and I knew what I needed to do, right? Knowing is very different than doing. And a lot of that was a disconnect in what is actionable. And over the past sort of 8+ years where I've really been trying to make sure that just because I know it doesn't mean I'm doing it. And I'm trying, you know, I'm just trying to be better, always trying to improve. And that's all I can do and not be the same person that I was in the past.
David, I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to talk with you. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being so open. I really appreciate it. I think it's very valuable to hear what you have to say.
Thank you so much.
David Chang is a chef and restaurateur and author of the new memoir, Eat a Peach. Our interview was recorded at a live Zoom event for WHYY, where Fresh Air is produced. Our thanks to Emily Kinslow for producing the event. The acclaimed new documentary, Collective, is Romania's entry for this year's Academy Awards. The film, which is available on demand and in virtual cinemas, follows a team of reporters whose investigation of a medical nightmare leads them to corruption among high-level corporate and government officials. Our critic at large, John Power, says Collective is a gripping story that speaks to our present moment.
Every year, the organization Transparency International gets a global team of experts and business people to rank countries by their level of public corruption. In the most recent rating, New Zealand and Denmark tied for first as least corrupt. The United States came in 23rd, which may not seem so bad, except that we've dropped nearly 10 places over the last 20 years. To see why this slippage matters, I highly recommend the fast-paced new documentary Collective. Alexander Nanau's great film trails a team of journalists investigating the aftermath of a 2015 fire at a Bucharest nightclub called Collective. It killed 64 young people and sparked public outrage over the political rot leading to these deaths. We start off following Catalin Tolentan, a locally famous reporter at the Daily Sports Gazette, who's looking into a startling fact. Although officials told parents that Bucharest's hospitals were as good as Germany's, 37 of the fire victims died there. How could this be? Thanks to tips from brave whistleblowers, nearly all of them women, incidentally, Tolentan traces many of these deaths to Hexi Pharma, a company that sold deliberately diluted disinfectants to Bucharest hospitals. Soon after his story appears, Hexie Pharma's owner kills himself, or so it seems, and the Minister of Health suddenly resigns. To trumpet its good faith, the government replaces him with Vlad Voiculescu, a boyish patient rights advocate who exudes such good-humored honesty and compassion that you hope he's not a crook. He plans to reform a medical system where burn victims have maggots crawling in their wounds, and everything works around a network of payoffs. Patients need to bribe doctors to get care, and hospital managers skim budgets and kick dirty money up to politicians. But Vlad's plans get him attacked by the ruling Social Democratic Party, which launches a demagogic campaign suggesting that actually he is the corrupt one. Now, I can hear you wondering why you would ever want to see a documentary about corrupt medical care, and in Romania, of all places. Well, for starters, it's a really good film that crackles with the excitement of a terrific mystery story. And unlike most docs these days, it doesn't lecture you or signal its own virtue. Nana lets us figure out for ourselves how this story casts light on what's happening in the world right now. Collective demonstrates the importance of an independent media, especially news reporters, in an age when governments seek to control information. Politicians fear a journalist like Tolentan, not because he's ideological, but because he's a born bloodhound who lives to track the scent of malfeasance. It takes him and his team to reveal that fire victims died because the hospitals were crawling with deadly bacteria because of the bad disinfectants. And their digging proves what many Romanians already suspected, that this failure is rooted in ruling party chicanery. It's not for nothing that Romania ranks 70th on the corruption index. Nana also shows what happens when the civil service becomes a tool of one person or party. The mobsters who managed Bucharest state-run hospitals didn't land their jobs because of their expertise in overseeing medical care. They were political appointees whose loyalty was not to their patients or their hospitals, but to their political patrons, with whom they shared graft money. Everybody who mattered got their beak wet, to use a phrase from The Godfather. What keeps Collective from becoming despairingly dark is that we spend most of our time with Tolentan and Vlad, honorable men who are fighting for truth and accountability. And the film has a third hero, too, whose significance isn't immediately apparent. Her name is Teddy Ursulianu, a 29-year-old architect who survived the Collective fire at great cost. Her head and body were terribly burnt. Her fingers had to be amputated. But rather than shrink into shame or defeatism, she refuses to let the darkness define her. She learns to use an artificial hand and fearlessly poses for nude photos, unsettling but not racy, designed to show the world the truth of who she is now. For Nana, Teddy's transformation of pain into art seems to offer a model for Romania and all countries wounded by corruption. You begin by acknowledging your deepest and most painful scars, and then move forward into a new vision of the future.
John Powers reviewed Collective, a new documentary from Romania. The film is distributed by Magnolia Pictures and is available in virtual cinemas and on many on-demand platforms. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Gillian Anderson can now be seen in two very popular and very different Netflix series. In the new season of The Crown, Anderson plays Britain's Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, contrasting her with another powerful woman, Queen Elizabeth II. Anderson also co-stars in the Netflix comedy series Sex Education as a sexy yet uptight sex therapist who's constantly embarrassing her 16-year-old son who's having sexual problems of his own. Gillian Anderson first became known for her role in the TV series The X-Files. She was just 24 when she started playing Dana Scully, the doctor who's assigned to work with David Duchovny's character, Fox Mulder, an FBI agent investigating paranormal phenomena and government conspiracies. Scully is the skeptic, believing in science, not aliens. The series lasted for 11 seasons and spun off two movies. We started by talking about The Crown, featuring Anderson as Margaret Thatcher, who was the leader of the Conservative Party and became the first woman prime minister in 1979, serving for 11 and a half years. Her administration upended British society, emphasizing deregulation, privatization, weakening of trade unions, and deep spending cuts that frayed the country's social service net. In this scene, Thatcher arrives for her weekly audience with the Queen, holding up a copy of the Sunday Times. Thatcher is angry, correctly assuming that the Queen has leaked to the press, that she's displeased at Thatcher's cuts to the social safety net and her resistance to imposing economic sanctions against apartheid South Africa. This goes against the Queen's tradition of never publicly expressing her political opinions or speaking against her government. The Queen, played by Olivia Colman, is trying to deny having engineered the leak. Thatcher speaks first.
I think we have enough respect for one another personally to ask ourselves some of the bigger questions. Woman to woman. We are the same age, after all.
Really?
Just 6 months between us.
Oh? And who is the senior?
I am. Ma'am. Uncaring. Confrontational and socially divisive. That's how these sources so close to the Queen describe me.
Prime Minister.
That I lack compassion. And that my government has done irretrievable damage to the country's social fabric. My responsibility for the time I have in office is to put sentimentality to one side and look after this country's interest with the perspective of a cold balance sheet. And while I greatly admire your sense of fairness and compassion for those less fortunate than us...
Do you? Really?
Let us not forget that of the two of us, I am the one from a small street in an irrelevant town with a father who could not bequeath me a title or a commonwealth, but only grit, good sense, and determination. And I don't want people's pity or charity or compassion. Nothing would insult me more. My goal is to change this country from being dependent to self-reliant, and I think in that I am succeeding.
I have had to learn many difficult lessons as sovereign.
Britons are learning to look after number one, to get ahead, and only then, if they choose, to look after their neighbour.
Of those?
No one would remember the Good Samaritan if he only had good intentions. You see, he had money as well.
Gillian Anderson, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your performance in The Crown.
Thank you very much.
Some actors really like putting on the clothing of a character and feel like the clothing helps them get into the character. And, you know, with Margaret Thatcher, you're wearing this like really like straight-laced clothing. She always seemed to be such like a rigid, starched person. And her hair literally looked starched. She'd have this like 1950s, early 1960s kind of hairdo, very like bouffant, and it looked like it was like glued together. She just seemed like physically rigid. Can you talk about what you wore and also the voice that you assumed to play her? Because as we could hear in your portrayal of Margaret Thatcher, she had a very measured, strong, precise, slow, powerful way of speaking.
Well, Kate Hall, who is our hair and makeup guru on The Crown, talks about the silhouette of all the characters, but in thinking about Thatcher's silhouette, that is both her particular girth coupled with the outline of, as you say, that bouffant slash helmet of sorts.
Yes.
And then her particular walk, which she, you know, kind of pumped her left arm as she held her right arm crooked with a handbag over it. And she would pump that arm and walk in quite small steps, even, you know, ahead of Reagan, ahead of Gorbachev, ahead of whoever she was walking with in their own country. But it was really, I think, getting comfortable enough in her vocal qualities, which, you know, as you say, is very measured and et cetera. But she would also known for her pitch sometimes, and especially in party conferences or, you know, when she was talking to large crowds and performing, as she knew that she was good at doing. She did raise the temperature and her pitch and the energy going into it. And so there's a lot more fluctuation in her public voice than we necessarily see in The Crown in so many of these indoor scenes.
Could you demonstrate what you mean by the fluctuations of her pitch?
She would talk like this, and she would very much breathe outwards when she was speaking, and she would take a breath in so that if you were going to interrupt her, she would breathe over and talk over you. But then sometimes if she was talking to an audience and there was a great many people who were speaking, she could really kind of bring the voice up here and speak to the larger crowd. And, you know, she would, you know.
That's great. You portray Thatcher with a slight hoarseness to your voice. How did you do that without hurting your voice?
There's so much breath in her voice that it was easy enough to be able to ground it in, you know, lower down in the diaphragm and not go too throaty.
How do you get more air in your voice, more breath in your voice?
It's kind of sighing at the same time. Try it, Terry Gross.
Like sighing.
Yes.
At the same time. Like this.
Very good.
Do I sound as authoritative as Margaret Thatcher? I don't think so. I sound foolish. But I see your point. I think I could work it up. Yeah. Just give me time. I'll get back to you.
Yes, it takes practice.
I find Thatcher a very interesting figure, in part because, like, she really is a pioneer in the world of women in politics. She's the first British prime minister in England. And she knows she's up against a very, like, male-oriented government. And yet she doesn't seem to generalize to other women and to become a supporter of feminism and of women's rights.
Well, I think the fact that she was in office normalized female success. And I think that, you know, the girls who grew up when she was running the country were suddenly able to imagine leadership as a female quality. But at the same time, she wasn't a feminist. She didn't have interest in social equality. She didn't really know anything about female solidarity. She had a lack of interest in childcare provision and positive action. And so she wasn't really a feminist icon. And yet she allowed young women to imagine that women could be suited to power. Her presence there was a real dichotomy. The fact that she only brought one woman cabinet member in the 11 years that she was in office into the cabinet is, you know, remarkable, astounding. And at the same time felt that she could control, stand up to, be on the same level, same footing as all the conservative men that were surrounding her. It's an incredibly, you know, it wasn't just incredibly male dominated, it was entirely male dominated.
Yes. The Crown is focusing in part on Margaret Thatcher's relationship with Queen Elizabeth II, two very powerful women. In order to portray Thatcher, you had to learn about some of the customs that you follow when you're in the presence of the Queen. What are some of those customs that you found, like, most interesting or most baffling or confusing?
Thatcher grew up as a monarchist, and she had almost a mystical reverence for the monarchy. But at the same time, she was anxious. She was nervous and obsequious, and there was a rigidity to the way that she behaved. And you kind of see all of that in the depth of her curtsy, which was infamously very, very, very deep. And so on the one hand, it points to the degree of her reverence. And on the other hand, there's an element of kind of awkward silliness and not quite understanding what you know, the right way to curtsy is, almost as if she's trying too hard. We see during different seasons of The Crowns, the prime ministers being educated about how to behave, how to enter, how you don't turn your back on the queen, you don't speak first, you wait to be spoken to, you don't ask questions, you wait, you know, all of that is, you know, very different from how the rest of us live. And so what we mostly see is her initial awkwardness and, you know, trying to figure out how the best way to sit is and how to read each other and get a sense of what their similarities are, because there are a huge amount of differences, but there are also some very stark similarities. Their Christianity and their age and the fact that they're mothers and their work ethic. And so it's a very interesting, sometimes copacetic, sometimes combative power play that happens between these two women during the course of the series.
In Sex Education, your character is very open about sex, but is actually becoming very intrusive in her son's sex life. Not that he has one. He wishes that he did. And I just want to say a little bit about the series. He's been feeling kind of like a freak because, you know, he doesn't have a relationship. He's never had sex. And in fact, he hasn't even figured out at the beginning of the series, how to pleasure himself. But after he gets the knack of that, he can't stop doing it. And there's a scene where he's actually, it's daytime, he's in a parked car, and he's doing it there, you know, in public view, in a public place, in this car, and his mother sees. And I want to play the conversation she has with him after that. So, here's my guest, Gillian Anderson, as the sex therapist and mother, and Asa Butterfield as her son.
I am so proud that you are at this stage of your pubescent development.
Okay, great. Can we please not talk about it?
However, there is a time and a place for such a private
Mom.
Activity. And I'm not sure the car, it being a shared space, is the most appropriate choice for such an event to occur.
Understood.
Revealing one's genitalia in public is also a criminal offence.
I will not do it again. I promise.
Also, I've noticed you've been taking very long showers lately. Now, I know that the bathroom is a safe environment in which to enjoy oneself, but I live here too, and I also need hot water. So if you could please keep that in mind.
Will do.
Isn't it wonderful how we've been talking so much more openly and honestly lately?
I have got to go.
Bye, darling. Love you.
You know, in the clip that we heard, it's very funny, but it also gets to something real, which is that, you know, parents want to be able to speak openly with their teenage children about sexuality, about what to expect with it, and, you know, to kind of guide them in some way. At the same time, a lot of people today came from more repressive environments where you didn't talk about sex, and parents were like wanted to be more open about it. But there is that line between being open and being intrusive, between being open and just like totally, you know, embarrassing your teenage child. And I know you have children. I don't think they're teenagers yet, but is this something you found yourself thinking about a lot?
I have three children, and two of them are teenagers, 12 and 14 boys. And I did consider it very, very carefully before taking on this part. And one of the things that I was afraid of was that, you know, they were just starting in a new school, and I was worried that it would affect them negatively to have a mom who was on a show that was so explicitly about things related to sex. And actually, particularly at that time, if it didn't do well, you know, if it didn't turn out as I was hoping it would turn out. But I think because the show has so much heart, and because The show is so diverse. It's so freeing. It's allowing a freedom of conversation that has not been seen before in television and has been embraced so passionately by all different ages, from parents and children alike. It actually went a long way towards, I think, bringing my children closer to me, in a sense of feeling that it was something that they could, that it was cool for the first time that I was involved in. And they've swore to me that they haven't seen it, and I'm pretending that I believe them. I think that I'm not Jean. I think that I'm surely not. I mean, I definitely have better boundaries than Jean, but I think I'm surely not as awkward and as intrusive and as blatantly embarrassing. And yet I find myself, you know, trying to have conversations with them or asking questions about, you know, under armpit hair that I haven't yet seen, and can I see it at the dinner table? It comes out of your mouth before you realize what you're doing. And of course, And so I think we all struggle with that, even if we think that, you know, we're cool parents. All parents are cringeworthy.
Gillian Anderson, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the crown.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor. Thank you, Terry.
Gillian Anderson plays British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in the new season of The Crown, which is now streaming on Netflix. She also co-stars in the Netflix comedy series Sex Education.